You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
From CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is Stay Tuned in Brief. I'm Preet Bharara. For the first time since 1979, Israel and Iran are engaged in direct military attacks on the other's soil. On April 13th, Iran launched more than 300 missiles and drones into Israel. This action was in retaliation for an airstrike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus, Syria, 2 weeks prior, on April 1st. That strike killed 7 people, including 3 senior members of Iran's powerful paramilitary organization, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, which supports militant groups throughout the region. Israel is believed to have been behind the strike, but has not claimed responsibility. Then, on Friday, Israel responded, attacking a military base in central Iran. Here with me to discuss what this all means for the future of the region is Iran expert Ray Tuckey. He's a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the author of many books on Iran and served as senior advisor on Iran at the State Department. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So obviously, my main question is and will be, what does all this mean for the possibility of a wider war in the region? But let's sort of begin at the top. Can you explain what happened on April 1st in Damascus?
April 1st, Israelis did what they had done before, targeting Iranian military personnel in Syria. And in this particular case, they killed, particularly their target was General Zahedi, who was an important figure in the Iran's paramilitary force and a sort of a conduit between the Islamic Republic and various proxies, particularly Hezbollah. But that was not all he did. There's some dispute about whether that was an attack on a diplomatic compound, which would obviously cause international legal problems because it's a sovereign immunity issue. The Israelis claim that the building they attacked was not registered with the Syrian government, but these are diplomatic niceties. This had happened before. The Israelis have been target killing Iranian military officials inside Iran and outside Iran, as well as nuclear scientists. So in of itself, this was not a departure from the usual pattern of shadow war between these two countries.
Why didn't Israel take responsibility for the Damascus attack?
They almost never do take direct responsibility for such actions. It's part of the way they conduct their campaigns on that front. They always let you know that they did it, and they leak and they press, they inform their press, but they don't issue an official proclamation suggesting they were responsible for this. This goes back. This is part of their practice and behavior for a long time, not just in this case.
But am I right that they did take responsibility directly for the Friday retaliation?
That's right.
So why deviate from the playbook for this one and not the earlier one?
I think it's part of the larger thing that is taking place in the Middle East, and they wanted to reestablish the deterrence line, which was obviously transgressed on October 7th. And for the Israelis, the Hamas attack and Iran are indivisible. They don't see them as separate. So they wanted to indicate to the Iranians that despite their preoccupation in the Gaza Strip, they are not taking their eye off the ball on other frontiers. And that was essentially I think the message that we're trying to send, the Israelis at this point are very preoccupied with rehabilitating their deterrence lies as they see it.
Yeah.
And that was part of the ongoing campaigns that they have. These are all, from their perspective, connected. What's happening in the northern frontier with Hezbollah, what is happening in Gaza, and the Islamic Republic as well. So they don't see these as separate entities, but rather connected.
Okay, so you have the Damascus strike on April 1. Then Iran, as everyone knows, sent at least 300 missiles and drones into Israel, first time launching an attack on the soil of Israel since 1979. It was an utter and spectacular failure. Why would Iran undertake to do that, presumably knowing that the likelihood of any kind of success was low, or did they not know that?
Well, this is something that everybody's speculating on, and my speculation is just that. Because as you suggested, it is the first time in 45 years of enmity where these two powers move beyond the limits of their conflict. Iran and Israel have been at odds since the inception of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, but they have waged their conflict with each other by use of proxies. The Iranians obviously use proxies such as Hezbollah and Hamas, and the Israelis rely on marshaling international community against Iran in terms of economic penalties, and lately cyber wars and targeted assassinations. It was a conflict that was waged within limits, with understood parameters. But the Iranians just blew those parameters into smithereens, or tried to, launching 300 missile projectiles against Israel can only be considered a mass casualty event. The question is, what did they think would happen if they had hit an apartment building and so forth? As you mentioned, this was a spectacular failure. And it was spectacular success for Israeli Air Defense Network and the coalition partners that it has assembled. But had it succeeded, we would have been in a very different place today. Why did they do it? One can only speculate, and there are a number of things that we can say. They may have felt that the Israelis were too preoccupied in Gaza to be able to respond in a measurable way. They may have perceived that they have to show some kind of a gesture of valor to their proxies as they were getting pummeled by the Israelis, particularly Hamas, and to a lesser extent, Hezbollah, that they had to essentially demonstrate their credibility to their proxies, which are engaging in a high-stake conflict with Israel. And there's also what we have seen in Iran over the past couple of years is a transformation of the political and security elite. The old actors that we are going familiar with are leaving the scene. The new people are coming in. There's a generational shift. We don't know much about the new generation of Iranian security leaders, Revolutionary Guard commanders, and so forth. And they seem to be bolder, brazen, and certainly risk-prone. So all these factors in some way could have led them to engage in the activity that they did. There may be other factors that we just don't know or just not apparent to us.
I just wonder if they thought, the Iranians thought, this was a symbolic gesture with the foreknowledge that it would fail and there would be all these interceptions, or if they were really hoping for multiple mass casualty direct strikes. And as you point out, we would have been in a very different world. And I'm trying to understand what the intention of Iran was and if they had thought through the consequences of success.
Well, I would say that you don't launch 300 projectiles, including ballistic missiles, hoping not to kill anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of understand that this could lead to casualties and therefore an altercation. You may have discounted the possibility of that altercation or its duration or its intensity. Second of all, I don't think the Iranians, who rely on missiles and drones as an important pillar of their defense structure, would want the attack to fail and therefore emasculate themselves. They didn't get around the table, say, let's launch an attack, hoping it fails, and then we'll stand emasculated in front of domestic audiences and international ones. I think that's a really good plan.
So then, but it's still, it seems to me to be a stupid plan.
It certainly is.
If they had been
is.
Successful. So I don't, I guess I keep going back to the question, what on earth were the Iranians thinking?
Yeah, the history of international relations is a history of miscalculations based upon stupid plans. and the hubris and confidence and arrogance that often leads countries to engage in activity that are self-destructive. This may have been, clearly is one of them. They seem to have survived this because of their lack of success. I can only say that in the turbulent Middle East today, with so much happening, and Israel under so much scrutiny and under kind of pressure from the United States and international community, as there are divisions between Israel and the United States on some issues today, they may have perceived all these things would redound to their advantage and the conflict would be limited. If that's the case, then we have to reassess this elite, not just as reckless, but as parochial in its outlook. In a sense, they don't seem to fully appreciate that traumatized countries like Israel will respond differently to such acts of aggression. So it was certainly miscalculation, but also based upon sort of evaluations that they have made, which from our perspective are, shall we say, unintelligent, if not arcane.
Yeah, I mean, you said in the New York Times piece recently, and I think you alluded to it earlier in this conversation, quote, "To be sure, Israel and America may both be at fault for giving Ayatollah Khamenei the impression that they had no appetite for escalation," end quote. Do you still think that's true?
I think as we sit here today, given the fact that this event did not lead to a measurable Israeli retaliation as far as we know today, I think the statement is largely correct as it stands. The Iranians tend to, at this point, discount not the reality of American power, but the possibility of its use against them. I mean, they can see the hardware. They understand the latent American power is quite considerable, and they do not wish to be entangled in a conflict with the United States.
So now the 300 missiles and drones are launched. They're effectively intercepted. What do you expect Bibi Netanyahu's initial impulse for a response was?
I tend to be somewhat of a revisionist on Prime Minister Netanyahu in a sense that I believe his bellicosity is often exaggerated and his bark is always worse than his bite. And throughout his tenure, he has actually been averse to confrontation. Now, if this strike by the Iranians has succeeded, then I think the Israeli war cabinet, and these are collective decisions in a war cabinet today, would feel compelled to respond in a drastic and measurable way. Whether that impulse could have been mitigated by the international community, of course, remains to be seen because it didn't happen. My guess would be, and this is just a guess, that the Israelis are inclined to declare victory and move on. Of course, that could prove famous last words. What we don't know at this stage is what this strike that the Israelis did against a military installation in Isfahan, was this a first salvo of a campaign that could unfold over weeks, or was this a one-off? And essentially what they signaled is that they succeeded in their defensive measures in preventing Iran from penetrating their airspace, and they succeeded symbolically in penetrating the Iranian airspace. And that might be enough for them. That is certainly what they're hearing from the international community, from the United States, from the European leaders and others. Second of all, this may actually, the Israeli restraint on Iran at this point may be a prelude to an Israeli aggressive move in Rafah, in Gaza. So
you think those are interconnected in that way?
Well, I think it's possible that Israelis are now feeling themselves, okay, we demonstrated to the international community and to our American critics that we're willing to be restrained in terms of a regional war, but this gives us some credit and a license to move and cleanse the Gaza Strip of remnants of the Hamas military contingents. So in the next couple of weeks, we'll find out what the Israeli intentions are, whether they're Gaza first people or they want to expand this conflict to particularly an escalatory dynamic with the Iranians, which will be very difficult to unpack.
I should note for folks that as we record this, it is Friday, April 19th at around the 10 a.m. hour Eastern time. And the reports I've seen so far this morning are that the Iranian reaction to this retaliation have been muted. Are you surprised at all by how quiet and restrained the Iranian reaction is?
to... Well, the Iranian reaction is consistent with the Israeli one. The Israelis officially are not announcing this. And actually, in some of the early reporting that I saw, and the reporting on this will be more comprehensive as the day goes on, the Israelis were miffed at the Americans for actually suggesting, for announcing this. So to some extent, that may be the case. On the other side, the Iranians will have essentially suggested that there was some unidentified object over their airspace and they have dealt with it. So they're also not acknowledging the Israeli penetration of the airspace. You can understand that for their own domestic audiences and so forth. But this is, we live in an information age, so that information is likely to penetrate Iran in a variety of formats. But I think if the Israelis had done measurable damage, then it would be hard to conceal. I think it's hard to conceal now.
Can I ask you, but maybe a naive question, as a non-foreign policy expert, why is it the case, if it is true, as you have said, that the history of warfare is example after example after example of miscalculation and mistake and overreaction and bad strategy? And also, Iran and Israel both keep saying, we don't want a war, we don't want a war, we don't want a war. Given those two things, why are they even engaging in a long-time, long-standing game of proxy war and clandestine conflict? Why do that?
Some of that has to be understood in the context of Iran's revolutionary ideology and Islamist ideology. The clerical elite and the political elite, not all of them are clerics, have long suggested Israel is an inauthentic state. Is an illegitimate state, that it has usurped Palestinian rights, and it is an instrument of American imperialism in the Middle East, and the job of resisting it is not just a strategic duty, but is indication of spiritual commitment. That's a deeply an ideological perspective, but it has certainly animated the clerical elite for 45 years. And I would say the opposition to State of Israel predated the Iranian Revolution in a sense that the members of the clerical community long rejected Israel as a nation state in the Middle East because of the perception that they're displacing the legitimate Palestinian rights. And Israelis have responded to that, of course, in their own way. And this enmity has continued all along. In some way, Iran's opposition to Israel is even more pronounced than its opposition to the United States. Because in terms of its official rhetoric, it calls for extinction of Israel. It actually doesn't call for extinction of America. They're both preposterous propositions. I understand
small,
that.
Small favors.
they're both, you know, if you're an American who's not that versed in Islamist politics of Iran, this may seem like outrageous propositions. But leaders have done destructive things in the name of ideology, such as communism. So this is a deeply an ideological antagonism on behalf of Iran. And it's been self-defeating for Iran. You know, its enmity with Israel has not served its interests. But, you know, a lot of regimes at time put ideology ahead of pragmatic national interest.
Yeah. So I want to go back to my first main question. Given where we sit and contemplate things today at this moment, what is your view of the prospects of a wider war in the region? And then obviously, very relevantly, the prospect of American entanglement.
Well, the latter is easier to decipher. The United States officials, the Biden administration officials, have stressed and they insisted that they don't intend to be involved in a larger Middle Eastern war, and their efforts at this point is to prevent such war from happening. So that means they are going to pressure the Israelis to declare victory and move on, and the Iranians seem to be playing along with it. So if this is all that's going to happen, this conflict may actually, or this stage of this conflict may actually be behind us, although it certainly can pop up at any time. If there is an Israeli strike to follow, then I think the Iranians will be compelled to respond. Then we're in this escalatory dynamic that you spoke about that nobody wants to be on. It's like the proverbial tiger's back. You know, once you get on it, it's hard to pick the place to dismount. And that sort of escalatory dynamic could get out of hand. At this point, if I had to guess, and this guess could be pronounced wrong as soon as we finish, is all three powers involved, the United States, Israel, and Iran, would like to calm things down. And if they can all respectively declare victory, then that may happen. Israelis can declare victory about their symbolic success in penetrating Iranian airspaces and preventing Iran from penetrating theirs. The Iranians can pretend they were not struck by Israel. And the Americans can suggest that the diplomatic offices functioned in aborting a conflict that could get out of hand.
Just move on. Final question. Do you have an assessment of how President Biden is handling the situation in the Middle East with respect to this and other things?
Well, it's an impossible situation to be in because you're essentially trying to control actors that are not always receptive to your advice. I think the administration will like Israel to finish with the Gaza war and have some kind of a ceasefire. That is a dispute between Israel and the United States, and like to calm things down. I would say in general, the Biden administration has not been that good about anticipating conflict. But once conflict comes, they've been reasonably good at tactically managing it and preventing its escalation. So they've been good at crisis management, but not always good at crisis anticipation. By the way, this is not a criticism in a sense that nobody foresaw what Hamas did on October 7th or what Iran did on April 1st. We are in a position where our adversaries, including President Putin, are behaving in a manner that they had not behaved before. So to be surprised at this stage about our adversaries' irrational conduct is not a criticism, but it's just a reality. But they've been very good generally in crisis management.
Ray Tuckey, thank you so much for your insight and your expertise. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
For more analysis of legal and political issues making the headlines, become a member of the Cafe Insider. Members get access to exclusive content, including the weekly podcast I host with former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance. Head to cafe.com/insider to sign up for a trial. That's cafe.com/insider. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. You can also now reach me on Threads. Or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The deputy editor is Celine Rohr. The editorial producer is Noah Azulai. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/Vox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.